Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for software engineering leaders. I'm your host, Aaron Seib. In today's episode, my guest is Adriana Villela, who is a leader in the open telemetry community and also host of the Geeking Out podcast, where she's had a lot of fantastic guests. So you should definitely check that out too. Adriana and I are going to have a wide-ranging conversation about observability and software applications, DevOps, and more. I'm sure you'll enjoy it, so stick around. And after you listen to this episode, how about sharing the Scaling Tech podcast with your friends and colleagues? Send them a link to this episode on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, LinkedIn, anywhere else you're joining us from. Thank you for listening to the Scaling Tech podcast and sharing our content with others. All right, let's get to my conversation with Adriana.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeat.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Adriana Villela is a senior tech leader who has been heavily involved in software development, DevOps, and site reliability engineering for over 20 years. Adriana is also a leader in the open telemetry community as a maintainer of the OTEL end user SIG and a senior staff developer advocate. She's a regular conference speaker, blogger, and host of the Geeking Out podcast. Welcome to the Scaling Tech podcast, Adriana.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
It's great to have you join me today. Really appreciate it. Been looking forward to this conversation. I want to start with a question about reliable systems, though. You've moved between management and individual contributor roles, as well as between development and DevOps roles. So based on that wide range of experience, what do you think is the most important thing that engineering leaders can do to enable their teams to build more reliable systems?
Honestly, I think it's the human component. It's creating a safe space for work. Because if you're working on a team where people aren't feeling, you know, that psychological safety, you know, for to be able to fail, to be able to tell, you know, their boss that like, oh, I made this mistake. It's going to just create this horrible culture of mistrust and, yeah. And then workers are going to be anxious and then no one's going to do a good job. So, yeah.
I love that answer. Psychological safety, yeah, is super important in, you know, any organizational culture, to be sure, in tech teams. Yeah, it's a great answer to the question because generally we're going to, you know, our tendency when things go wrong after we play the blame game, which hopefully we don't do if there's psychological safety, right? But the next instinct people who are not paying attention to that is, okay, what do we need to change in our tools? What do we need to change in our process? And we tend to look at those before the human element. But these are all human-driven systems. We are all humans. And so that is incredibly important. I love that answer. Let me build on that a little bit with you and ask, you know, kind of in how do you create psychological safety in a team that is dealing with, you know, like a fire in production as you know, one of those really stressful situations that we've probably all been in?
I think like as a manager, just making sure that you protect your team from, you know, various people breathing down your team members' necks. Cause, you know, how many incidents have we heard of where, you know, you've got the poor folks trying to resolve the incident and then there's all these execs jumping on whatever call and then they're like, I used to be a developer and perhaps you could restart the database and like, right. Come on, buddy, just like let the professionals do their jobs. So I think giving right. that level of protection from management is extremely important. And making sure that your team members know that, like, you know, it's, yeah, you made a mistake, but these things happen. We have to move past the mistake. Like, we can't just, like, ruminate on it. And I think to a certain extent, too, and this is much harder. I think the folks on the outside who are, you know, experiencing that system failure, like, say you want to order your favorite food on Uber Eats and it's acting up. And you're like, ah, oh, piece of crap software. These idiots, they don't know how to maintain a system. Blah, blah, blah. Like, we need to be a little bit more gentle with how we react to these things. Cause it's like, at the end of the day, there are humans who are madly working behind the scenes, trying to fix these things, make sure that they're up and running.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like anytime I get a flight canceled, I have to remind myself as I'm, texting or calling with customer support that this is a stressful situation for me. But I've also worked on the customer service side of organizations and seen, these are absolutely humans on the other side of it. And we need to treat them as such. I think a lot of it for me, part of the role of that manager in that situation is around communication and, I think you said like protecting the team in that situation. So having the manager be the one who, is communicating back to the executives progress of how thing is going and discouraging those executives from, opening a direct Slack channel with the primary engineer looking at the problem, that sort of thing. Right. Because for me also having been on the management side of things, when a system is failing, what always makes me the most anxious, as a leader on the non-technical side in those situations is if I don't know what's going on.
Yes.
Right. So that can be that, we talk about like servant leadership as management, being a servant leader to their team. That's a prime time to be a servant leader and help your team by making that communication up and, out to others concerned about this problem in the system. So thank you for that answer around the human aspect of it. Let's, without neglecting that incredibly important human aspect of it, let's talk a little bit about tooling and observability, though. Tell us about OpenTelemetry. For those who may not be familiar with it already, what is it and how you became interested in the work of observability in software applications?
Yeah, so OpenTelemetry is a CNCF project, and it's a set of tooling that enables observability by standardizing like how we send data to systems to basically make them observable. So the main things that OpenTelemetry will emit are traces, metrics, and logs, which are known as the three pillars, and they just added profiling to the mix, but the idea is, back in the day, it was every tool out there like had their own set of libraries. There was no standardization. So if you wanted to switch to a different vendor, you basically had to re-instrument your code. So basically add the code to your code that emits those signals, those traces, metrics, and logs. So that you could send it out to that vendor tool. But with the advent of OpenTelemetry, various observability vendors came together and said, let's standardize this thing so that we're not worrying so much about like what's distinguishing us isn't the data that we're sending. We're all receiving this same data. So what distinguishes one vendor from another is how they interpret the data. What are they doing with the data in a way that you, as the SRE, can look at stuff and say, okay, I have an inkling as to what's going on, and allows them to troubleshoot. Yeah. And I think that's the thing that's exciting about OpenTelemetry. And what I love about it too is because it comes from this position of vendor neutrality, it has the backing of all the major observability vendors out there, and they're very deliberate about, making sure that we're not elevating one vendor over another. In fact, there have been a few instances where, folks will submit a blog post, and if it like mentions one particular vendor, they're like, can we, maybe exclude that? Because it's really not about favoritism. It's really about making sure that we focus on the vendor neutrality aspect of it. And folks are very, they approach it in a very like polite manner, which I really appreciate, because that's another thing with open source is, when you file a pull request, You are putting yourself out there. You are being sure. vulnerable to the entire world, saying, look at my work. I have created this thing. Please accept it.
Please approve it, literally.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And it's terrifying. And, you know, I filed my first pull request 2 years ago. Like, I've been in tech for, you know, 24 years, and I filed my first like pull request for specifically for open source 2 years ago. And it was terrifying, but, you know, fortunately it was part of this lovely community. And when they were reviewing the pull requests, rather than say, oh, the scrap, it was more like, oh, you know, this is great. Great start. Like, here are some areas where you might want to improve. These are just a few suggestions. And right. so that put me really at ease. And so now it makes me a lot less scared when I go submit subsequent pull requests. And I always mention this to various people who are looking to get started with OpenTelemetry as well, because to kind of take that pressure off. It's like it's a welcoming community. They'll ensure that you are treated with respect and that your contributions are valued.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's the way open source should work, right? But yeah, I imagine totally. A lot of it comes down to the the leadership, the maintainers behind any given project, of whether or not they have that, you know, that sort of psychological safety, you know, built into the open source community. So that's fantastic. And I definitely like too, in general, the, you know, what you talk about with OpenTelemetry as a standard for metrics and observability and logs, and how that it's reducing vendor lock-in. Right.
Exactly.
And so that's tremendously important. And so I presume that, you know, means the vendors who utilize it, they have to compete more for their clients with, you know, how well do they help you analyze that data, use that data, et cetera. And I think that's, you know, that's the right place to be for sure. There's so many choices that we make in software architecture in general that we do become a little locked into, whether it's language or, you know, third-party tools, APIs, whatever the case may be, that it can be really hard to move from one thing to another. So in something like observability, that's so important to overall reliability and, the reliability and usability of our systems over time, I think it's an incredibly important area to have that sort of more vendor neutrality. So that's fantastic.
I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, edtech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures, and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution.
What would you recommend to, what advice do you have for managers about the adoption of OpenTelemetry in their systems?
I would say it feels like a no-brainer to me to adopt OpenTelemetry because, you know, nowadays, if you want to have reliable systems, you cannot ignore observability. And what better way to make sure that your system is observable than to use to instrument your code using like a standard like OpenTelemetry, where you have like standardized APIs and SDKs that provide that for you. I guess the challenge is when you're asking organizations to instrument their code, and they haven't instrumented their code before, you are basically introducing technical debt. Like new technical debt into the organization, right? Especially if they have a well-established application. Yeah, so right. You are basically saying, hey, we need to do this, but we're introducing new technical debt. And that can be a really tough pill to swallow. But if you consider the fact that, you know, say you've got an application that's constantly on fire. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to like not be in that state? And if there's a way to do that, and if it means investing a little bit extra time so that your application isn't like running on Band-Aids and duct tape, it feels like it feels like a compelling reason to use OpenTelemetry as a result.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to just be able to point to those times in the past where something happened in the system and it, you know, it took an hour to figure it out because nobody knew what was going on and how the impact that had on the organization, the stress that has on the team. You know, I mean, implementing things like this, reducing technical debt in general, I think helps with turnover in engineering teams because they, you know, they tend to feel like they're being listened to. They're able to improve the system. They're not just constantly putting out fires. And with building in more observability, I would think it only amplifies that you know, positive vibes in the team and returning reducing turnover because they'll know that, okay, last week was a shit show. That was hard, but next time it's going to be better.
Exactly.
And not just because we want it to be, but because we've got better tools in place to handle it. So
exactly. And you know, it, in a way, it's like you're introducing technical debt to pay down other technical debt, like the worst technical debt. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What do you think is the biggest thing that software teams forget about when they implement observability into their apps? You know, like what should the tech leaders be reminding them to do as they build this in? Maybe to reduce that pain of that lower technical debt while trying to, eliminate the bigger technical debt.
Yeah. So actually the biggest one is like getting into the habit of instrumenting your code as you write it, because, you know, we've got into the habit now of like writing tests as we code, which is awesome. And we, even when we write our code, we'll like slap in log statements, right? I mean, we do that for debugging. We do that so that when things go caca, we know what's going on. So, I mean, when you're instrumenting your code using something like OpenTelemetry, that's basically the same as like, yeah, you're adding logs using OpenTelemetry. So getting folks to get into that habit of doing that as they code. So it does mean like extra steps, but when you think about it, it benefits so many folks along the line, like down the road, because first of all, you have the developers who are instrumenting their code, so they can actually use OpenTelemetry to troubleshoot their own code. Hey, bonus. And then for like QAs, when they're testing the code, they have received this instrumented code. They can, as they're testing, say they encounter a bug, they're like, oh, there's a bug. Hey, the code's instrumented. I can use the instrumented data to figure out what's going on. So then they can go back to the developers and say, found a bug. I think this is where it's coming from. Or if they find a bug and they don't know where it's coming from, that is also a good indicator because it's saying your code's under instrumented. And then down the line to the SREs, when this code goes into production, you also have like the greater insights into your application because the code is instrumented. I think the trick becomes when, you know, you start from zero and you have like no instrumented code, you haven't used OpenTelemetry. How do you get started? Because that can be really scary as well. And yeah, one of the best things that you can do is just, you know, look at the different like workflows in your application and what are the most common workflows. So instrument the most common workflows there, right? Especially the ones that tend to be on fire the most, right? Because if those are the ones that tend to be on fire the most, maybe it'd be useful to get some insights into what's going on. And then once you've done that, also, you know, a lot of applications, they have like homegrown libraries and frameworks that they rely on. Instrument those, because when you instrument those, you're increasing the coverage of instrumentation in your code. So then that can help ease things a bit. I mean, yes, it's still going to be work at the end of the day. And I think one of the things to avoid, and I consider this an anti-pattern, is avoid the temptation to ask your SRE team or your so-called observability team to instrument your developer's code. And I speak about this from personal experience, because I worked at an organization where I ran an observability practices team, and they really wanted to, you know, do the observability thing. But they're like, we ain't got time to instrument this stuff. Can't your team, you know, instrument our code? Can't your team create dashboards for us? And I'm like, But I don't even know, like, what your code does. Like, I'm not the developer. It's like, you know, what if I said, hey, Aaron, can you, like, comment my code for me or write my unit test for me?
Right.
You don't know what I'm writing, but I think you should be able to do it, no problem. Like, that's how awkward that ask is. And so organizations have to avoid that temptation because it's not going to end well for anybody. Like, it's not going to get instrumented properly and you're going to piss off your SRE and your developers are going to be like, what the hell are you instrumenting? Like, no.
Yeah. No, it's a great comparison to make of, you know, asking someone else to comment a developer's code. And it really gets to kind of a classic anti-pattern in software team management in general of having people work too much in their silos, right? That, you know, developer doesn't have to worry about testing. That's a testing team's problem. Developer doesn't have to worry about security. That's a security team's problem. Developer doesn't have to worry about observability and instrumentation. That's the SRE's problem, right? It has to be a collaborative effort between all of them. And so I like the, best practice you recommended there of talking about building in your instrumentation as you go, just like developers are accustomed to building in some automated testing as they go for the work. So how do you test that instrumentation that you're building in to, you know, to make sure that it works, that you're not having false negatives of thinking you've instrumented things and, you know, the logs are going nowhere and you don't realize it when problems are happening. How do you test this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's one of those things where I think, like, because you're instrumenting early enough, your QAs can help with that. Because, like I said, you know, if they're able to use your instrumented code to troubleshoot, then that indicates that things are going well, that you're at least in the right direction. But also, if you're in terms of, like, is the instrumentation working? Making sure that, like, when you instrument your code, you're actually seeing it in your observability backend. Because if you're not seeing it, there could be a number of things that are happening. Maybe it's never getting to your instrumented code. Maybe there's something broken, like a broken pipe, right? Like OpenTelemetry has this component. It's optional, but highly, highly recommended, called the OpenTelemetry Collector, which basically it's used to, it's like a data pipeline. So it ingests your instrumented data. You can apply transformations to it if you want. You can do things like adding, removing attributes. You can mask your data. You can batch your data. And then it exports it somewhere. And that somewhere is your observability backend, i.e. the software that is receiving your instrumented code. So it could be like there is something gone awry, you know, in your configuration, your collector, as far as like sending it to your observability backend. It could be that your collector is not working. It's so much more than just like, oh, is my code instrumented correctly? Because now you have, there's also like additional considerations, right? You're running this collector. You have to manage the infrastructure to run the collector, and the collector can be run in different ways. You can run it in Kubernetes standalone. You can, you know, load balance your collectors. So now this becomes like also like an infrastructure problem, an SRE problem in that sense for maintaining that infrastructure. So you really do need, as you said, to have that collaboration.
Yeah. And testing it at scale.
Exactly.
It makes a lot of sense. So doing some chaos engineering, some testing a little bit in a production or a production-like environment, at least, so that you're testing all those different scenarios. Yeah, that's great. It was also interesting what you said about the how overwhelming it can be for a team, you know, with a big legacy system with no instrumentation in it, of where and how to build that in for the first time when they're starting from zero. And it's kind of it's a classic twist on the problem of refactoring any legacy application, right? You know, being afraid to touch anything, even to put instrumentation on it, because just trying to gently put a little instrumentation on it might make a lot of skeletons fall out of the closet, right? And so we're trying to avoid that. Do you have a different sort of a way you approach that or think about things, you know, their impact, their risk, their most likely to break? You know, you mentioned just kind of looking at some of the core business processes.
Yeah, I think, you know, you don't have to necessarily boil the ocean to start seeing value out of like instrumenting your code. But there's this other thing that you can do with OpenTelemetry, where a number of languages have this thing called auto instrumentation, or I think now it's called zero code instrumentation, because as the name implies, you don't actually have to touch your code to be able to instrument it. And the idea is a number of languages, and some of them include like Java, Python, .NET, JavaScript, I think even Go. And on the most part, the way it works is you have like these wrappers that basically inject the instrumentation for you. And especially like if you're using like very common libraries, like Python Flask, for example, if you use Python Flask as part of your Python code and you're using this OpenTelemetry like auto instrumentation agent for Python, then it means that when you run your code, you'll actually see traces being emitted, and you don't have to do anything for that, which is very nice, because it's, and honestly, like the first time I saw auto instrumentation, I'm like, what magic is this? Like, it does feel magical. And so it's great. And I think it lowers the barrier to entry for many folks, because now they can start seeing the benefits of instrumentation without necessarily going in and instrumenting their code right away. And I feel like this can kind of get people sold on the idea of OpenTelemetry as well, and make them a little bit more curious, like, hey, now what if I did some manual instrumentation to complement that, which I think becomes really, really powerful.
Nice. Well, and since you said magic, that gives me a great segue to ask you about the role of AI and ML in observability and SRE in general. Like, what do you see as the role of AI in observability, and sort of where the future lies with this?
I think I see it as an assistive technology. I don't think anything's really going to replace the human, but AI can, you know, maybe spot some trends that we might not necessarily notice. And so, you know, having that in our tooling can say, hey, Adriana, like, take a look at this. This might look fishy. And you'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, that might be worth digging into a little bit more. Or you can say, no, AI, you're full of crap. But either way, like, it might surface stuff that you might not necessarily be aware of. And I think that can be extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that the trend with AI in general, right, is very, very assistive, but human in the loop is a key concept for sure. So on observability, is it possible to build in too much observability? I mean, if this is the right word to use, you know, how much noise around an application is worth saving? Data's cheap. We don't care about that.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And there's a couple of things. So first of all, like some applications, so with the auto instrumentation, for example, it is possible to auto instrument too much. And in fact, like being part of the OTel end user SIG, like we speak to end users a lot and hear a lot of end user stories. And then one of the end user stories that we heard, I think last year, was like, we over-instrument our code because like there was too much auto instrumentation, it was too much noise, and we couldn't tell like what was the stuff that we needed versus the stuff that we didn't need. So one of the nice things that's part of the OTel auto instrumentation libraries is now you can do a few things to like reduce the noise somewhat. So it's like, because right now I believe the way it works is, if you have like auto instrumentation turn on for like Python, for example, any libraries that you use that have auto instrumentation built in, like they're just going to emit the signals. And so now you have the ability to say, okay, I want auto instrumentation for like these three libraries, but not for these five. And so that I think reduces a lot of the noise. And then there's the other side of it too, where, you know, in order to save on data, because like you are emitting a lot of data through instrumentation, depending on what vendor you're using, they have different pricing models. And so many organizations will do sampling to basically limit the data that's being sent out. To basically, so again, it'll save them on costs. Now the trade-off with sampling is it might be that the error that you're experiencing was sampled out. And so it never makes it in. So that makes it quite tricky when it comes to these types of things, is just to figure out what should you include. Another thing I've read about it a while back. I don't know that anyone actually does it, but I think it's a really interesting concept, which is using feature flags. So that you use feature flags to enable and disable like your instrumentation. So, you know, by default, you're not emitting all the instrumentation that you've coded. But then say you're seeing issues in production, maybe it's time to turn things on. You know, it's like making your, you know, going from info to debug in your log level, right? So that you can get that extra bit of insight, but not until you start noticing things are going seriously bad that you would necessarily want to have that extra level of granularity.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Being able to do that in real time as you're, you know, looking at something in production. I imagine there's also considerations around what granularity of data do we keep indefinitely, and, you know, at what level can we kind of purge data periodically, just for the sake of not having everything sitting around indefinitely. So there's a lot of interesting things to consider. Generally speaking, we should be doing more observability, but keeping in mind there can be limits of maybe, you know, like auto instrumentation doing a little bit too much. So tweaking it to your individual environment. Strong collaboration within your team across those different roles of kind of working together on that, adding it in over time to legacy systems. A lot of great concepts here that you've brought up, and I appreciate a lot for, I think there's a lot here for engineering leaders to consider. You have, I'll move on from a little bit about observability, and I know you have moved from large enterprises that use very closed source software and into open source as part of your work with OpenTelemetry. You talked about a few minutes ago about the joy of submitting your first pull requests and getting those approved. Tell us a little bit more about what was that transition like for you from a very closed source world into open source, and how did it change your view of software?
I think for me, it was a very natural transition because I worked at a bank for 11 years and it's like so close. It was to the point where like, you know, we were using open source tooling, like, cause it was a Java shop. So like Java, Maven, Gradle, like, and yet, you know, I remember we're sitting in like an architecture review meeting and we're looking to use, I forget what other open source software for something or other. And they're like, no, it's open source and we need to have like a vendor managed option. Otherwise we can't use it. And I'm like, no, y'all use like Java, Maven, Gradle, and that stuff's open source.
Right.
What? They kind of freaked out. I'm like, you know, like I understand the aversion to risk when you're a large financial institution, like there is a lot at stake. But you know, sometimes it can be like very irritating as well because things move so slowly and yeah. You know, there were so many times when I wanted to have like given talks and they're like, oh no, you can't, because you know, like what if you say something that, you know, like can, you know, you say something inadvertent that puts things in a bad light. And, you know, so there's that constant fear. I mean, of course you, no matter where you work, you want to make sure that you're not like putting your foot in your mouth, but there's that extra level of paranoia when you work in a financial institution and things are very closed and you like, you know, contribution to open source was not encouraged. And so when I, you know, moved into a job where we were allowed to work with open source and we were encouraged to contribute to open source, I'm like, oh my God, where have you been all my life? Like it was a breath of fresh air. It was just, it exposed me to like this wonderful community that I didn't even know was like lurking out there, you know? So it's been lots of fun just meeting so many different people and getting so many like cool viewpoints and learning so much from folks who, you know, they might not have been in the industry as long as me, but they've been in open source longer. So there's always something to learn as a result of that.
Oh, that's great. And Yeah, I mean, you talk about getting more involved in the community as part of that. What advice do you have for other engineering leaders who want to become more active in the tech community? Maybe they've been working in that bank their whole career too.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess it can be challenging if you work at a job that doesn't encourage or won't allow you to work in open source because of you know, concerns around like security and whatnot, and that is fairly valid. And if you are in a position where you're able to, and you know, I admit, like, not everyone is in a position to be like, well, peace out, I'm going to find a new career and I'm going to work in open source. Like, you know, maybe that is not something that you're in a position to be able to do. But if it is, and an opportunity arises, and that's like more aligned with your kind of thing, like, I think that's a great opportunity. Also, like, you know, if you're able to do open source work on the side, and you know, if it's something that interests you, that's another way that you can get involved. Of course, like, just making sure if you work at an organization that is very sensitive to outside activity, like, make sure that that is cool with them, right? Even if it doesn't interfere with your job, that is still like something that you need to be aware of, that, you know, they might not be okay with you working in that. So these are things to keep in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that if they're sensitive to that, it's got to be something that's completely separate in topic and technology from what you're doing through work, at least.
Exactly.
Speaking of you know, other things that you do outside of your immediate job responsibilities, you have the Geeking Out podcast. Tell our listeners a little bit more about that, and maybe some of your favorite conversations.
Yeah, so I started the Geeking Out podcast about a year ago. Yeah, I think it was like Labor Day last year was my first, or day after Labor Day was my first episode. And I started, so before that, I used to have a podcast at work called On Call Me Maybe. And I used to have a co-host, Ana Margarita Medina, who's still my coworker, but we sadly, we had to retire the podcast, even though we loved doing it. And I felt like this void after the podcast was retired. I'm like, I need to start something else. I want to continue podcasting. I'd never done it up until then. And it was terrifying. I'm like, oh my God, what if I suck at this? And having like a podcast co-host, like, to ease things in, like, ease into the podcasting world was very helpful, especially because we had like a really great dynamic. So like going into Geeking Out, like doing this on my own, I was like, okay, I got this. I've got the experience. And so I started it with my daughter, Hannah, who's now 16, going to get her driver's license soon.
Oh, exciting times.
I know, right? And so like, cause I was telling her, I'm like, before we actually had for On Call Me Maybe, we had a producer who would edit our episodes and do the audiograms. And all we had to do was like, you know, tell her what clips we wanted to use for the audiograms and give her like do the show notes. For Geeking Out, I have to do everything by myself. So I spend most of my time like on the transcripts, like making sure that the transcription software that I use isn't spewing out shit.
Right.
So that it's like coherent, right?
Right.
That's honestly where I spend the most amount of time. And then Hannah does the editing for the episodes, which takes a fair bit off of my plate. It makes it definitely a lot easier. And she actually also did the design for the graphics, for the podcast. So, I've had some really interesting conversations on the podcast. One of the things that I really want to do as a fellow woman in tech is really elevate the voices of other women in tech. Doesn't mean that I don't have men on my podcast, but I do have a lot of women in tech featured on my podcast. You know, as a woman in tech who for so many years worked on teams where I was the, you know, the only woman or one of the few women, I think working in open source in the last little while has exposed me to more women in tech. I'm like, we do exist. So being able to find other women and really elevate their voices has been a lot of fun. And so some of the fun conversations I had were with like Abby Bankser, for example, who does a lot of speaking around platform engineering. And I actually connected with her initially because she had done a lot of speaking around observability and QA, because that was kind of her niche area initially. And now she's moved over to platform engineering and she's fantastic and knows so many people. She's like the Kevin Bacon of tech, I swear. So that's been a fun conversation. I've had Charity Majors on in January. That's been great. She's always a riot and she always has like fun, spicy opinions and so many great insights on things. Our debut episode after our summer break was with Liz Fong Jones. So that dropped, I guess, 2 days ago. Uh-huh. And then definitely a highlight was getting Kelsey Hightower on my podcast, and getting him on was a story of like just being at the right place at the right time. Because I met him at KubeCon North America last year and there was like a book signing. And he was at a book signing and I was like, I want Kelsey Hightower to sign my book. This sounds awesome. So I got in line. The line looked huge, but I'm like, I don't care. I had a talk later that day. I'm like, I think I still have time to be in line before my talk. So I got in line and then I get to the front and I was wearing a mask and the mask had this sticker here, the Geeking Out podcast sticker that was designed by my daughter, Hannah. And he's like, what's Geeking Out? And I'm like, oh, it's my podcast. He's like, oh, I do podcasts in the fall. I can be on your podcast if you want. I'm like, what? Excuse me? What? So, and then so I messaged him afterwards and he replied right away and booked a time and we recorded and he was basically my closer for like before going on winter break. And it was honestly a highlight because I he'd been on my like podcasting list for so long, but I'm like, how the hell am I going to get Kelsey Hightower on my podcast? And lo and behold, opportunity presented itself. I could not pass it up. So that was lots of fun. So yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah. I love that you've got it as a family operation now in the podcast with your daughter. That's really cool too. We'll definitely link to some of those episodes in the podcast from our show notes at scalingtechpod.com. So the conversation you had with Kelsey and about the future of Kubernetes, really interesting. And Charity Majors talking about, I think it was like personality conflicts with your managers and things like that. So you cover a lot of things from, DevOps and observability to also the human side of your work. And I definitely like that. Enjoy the opportunity to do that myself. And in our podcast, it's a lot of fun for me. I can see where, like when you have that gap without doing a podcast, how you missed it. I think I would probably feel the same way. It's a lot of fun for me to have these conversations. And kudos to you on doing a wonderful job with the Geeking Out podcast. It's really excellent. And I love that also using it as a platform for elevating women in tech. I think is fantastic too. So I know on the podcast, you like to ask your guests this, so I'm going to take the chance to turn the question on you. What is your superpower?
Ooh, what a great question. So my superpower, over the last few years, I've realized that my superpower is like, I learn things really fast. And then I have a knack for disseminating like my learnings in a very relatable way. It's so funny because I didn't even realize I was doing it until, I was getting feedback on my blog posts. Cause honestly, like blogging is still like my favorite medium for disseminating information, where people would be like, oh my God, thank you. Like you have such an approachable voice in tech and I was able to follow your instructions so well. And so for me, yeah, that is my superpower is just, and I don't know, I think maybe it's powered by anxiety a little bit, like the learning fast bit, like because I find the technology so interesting that I'm like, yes, this is really cool. I must like work on it until I figure it out. So yeah.
Oh, that's a good superpower to have, definitely to be able to not only be passionate about and to you know, build and do excellent technical work, but to be able to explain and disseminate that is definitely a gift that lots of people, you know, benefit from in being able to read that. It's super valuable. So that's great. As we wrap up here, I just want to ask you one other, you know, question around, you know, another thing that happens a lot in technology. I've certainly been through it myself as well. Just, you know, being burnt out in tech. It's a big deal. I like that people talk about it a little bit more in general. How do you keep your skills fresh? How do you fight, you know, burnout in our industry?
So for me, it's so funny. Like, I've had conversations with various people and it's such a personality thing. So for me, I have to like just isolate certain things. Like if I find that I'm getting really overwhelmed and thinking about all the things on my to-do list, I'm like, okay, I just have to block out the rest of the world and focus on the thing that's most important to me. Like, what do I have to do now? And let's just forget everything else and do this. And that means like, if that means I have to cancel certain meetings to be able to focus on my work, if it means that I have to ignore non-important Slack channels. So basically, it's like only the things that like are catching fire are uber important. I allow those to trickle in. Otherwise, I have to block everything out. But it's so interesting talking to other friends because they're like, the only way I can stay sane is I have to be in the know on every single conversation. So they will check all of the Slack channels and read all of the messages. And for me, like, that's so overwhelming. Yeah. So that's one thing. The other is learning to say no, which is so hard. So yeah. Hard because you want to please everybody. And especially when people ask like, oh, I loved your work on blah, blah, blah. Could you do blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, oh my God, you love what I did. How can I say no to them? But like you have, you know, like for example, in, I think it was in June, someone contacted me about like, oh, you know, like there's some virtual talk coming up and would you be interested in doing it? And I was looking at the dates and it was going to be while I was going to be away on my vacation in July. And I have a policy of like zero work on vacation. And I've stuck to that. I'm very proud of that. And then, so I wrote back to her and said, yeah, unfortunately I'm going to be on vacation. She's like, oh, you know, you can pre-record. Would that be helpful? I'm like, I thought about it for a split second and I thought, you know what? I could, but like, that's just going to add so much more stress to my plate. And I don't need that. Because there's a difference. I think really knowing the difference between like the nice to haves and the absolutely must do's. And, you know, that was at that point a nice to have. And even though there's, especially in DevRel, like everything's an opportunity to like continue building your personal brand. And, you know, and that's why I think it's so tempting to say yes to things, especially if you start getting invited to things. But if you find yourself in a position where you're too burnt out to do it, like, then what's the point? You're not putting in full effort, or like something else is giving, right? You're spending less time with family, you're neglecting your, you know, your physical health, your emotional health. And so just taking a step back, not making knee-jerk decisions and thinking, okay, is this something that I have the capacity to do? And the other thing too, that, you know, it's a hard one to do, but saying no to stuff, sometimes it's important to say no to stuff that you've already committed to. And that's hard because you don't want to come off as flaky, right? Oh, you know, she committed to this and now she's backing out. But if it's something where like it's going to have a seriously adverse effect on your mental health, people are more than understanding when you say like, there's too much on my plate. I'm so sorry, but I have to back out of this. And, you know, I've had these conversations with DevRel friends who've had to do that sort of thing. And it feels shitty to do it. But at the end of the day, like, you know, because you're letting someone down, but at the end of the day, like it's the right decision for you and having to say no to a previous commitment to protect your mental health. So, you know, you're one step further away from ending up hospitalized. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's tough to strike that healthy balance between work and personal. But if you can't bring your full self to both, then you're, you know, you're cheating yourself and others. So it's really important solid advice there. Thank you so much, Adriana, for everything you've shared with our listeners today. I really enjoyed our conversation. How can our audience learn more about your work and also the Geeking Out podcast?
So you can find all of my socials under this nice little umbrella on this website called Bento, like Bento Box, .me/Adriana M. Villela. So Adriana M. Villela. So you can see all my social links to all my socials there, links to my blog, links to Geeking Out podcast. It's all there.
All right.
Happy to continue having the conversation with folks who are interested in any of the topics that we discussed today.
Fantastic. We appreciate it. And I know our listeners do as well. And we'll put links to all of that up on scalingtechpod.com as well. Thank you so much, Adriana, for joining me today on the Scaling Tech Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeed.com. That's agilityfeat.com.